The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
Mr. Speaker, Britain's economic plan is working.
Yeah! Economic growth has been revised up and unemployment revised down. But austerity will continue as George Osborne claims a responsible recovery. I'm here at the Resolution Foundation in London, where assembled experts have had a day to crunch the numbers and to see how the dust has settled the morning after. Also this week...
We soon grasp the fact that we are not conducting a struggle against individual whites. We are fighting a principle.
We look at the enduring legacy of a political colossus as the death of Nelson Mandela provokes an outpouring of emotions across the globe. But right now, I'm joined by the Resolution Foundation's number cruncher, Matthew Whittaker. We've heard a lot, Matthew, about good news yesterday. Growth up a bit, deficits down a bit to what was expected in March. But how did forecasts change on the one thing you keep an eye on, how much people get paid?
Unfortunately, what we've seen on wages is that yet again, the forecast has got worse. What we've seen over the course of this downturn really is that employment has surprised on the upside. So unemployment hasn't risen in the way that people were predicting, given the size of the downturn. But wages have just consistently not kept pace with inflation. Now, what we're looking at now is that as of 2014, at last, we're going to be in a situation where average wages should start matching inflation again. But there's a long way back. And previously what the OBR was saying was that we'd reached the pre-recession levels once again by about 2017. Right. Now we're actually looking at 2018 instead. So it's been pushed out a bit further. And actually, if you to wind the clock back to what the OBR was saying back in 2010, they were thinking we'd be back where we were in 2008 by 2013. So the situation just keeps on getting worse. And obviously that has severe implications for the recovery.
Politically, what matters, I know you've got to think about the policy, but just on the politics of it, do you think that wages will be just starting to nudge ahead of inflation so people are getting off better finally in real terms just this side of the election? Or do you think it's more likely that won't happen in a meaningful way till after the election?
I think we'll start to see the improvement before the election, and certainly allied with the fact that employment will be going up as well, I think the government will be able to point to the fact that the economy is starting to improve and that is starting to feed back through to people's pockets. But if people want to make the comparison with how things used to be when the government came into power, they'll actually see that they're not any better off.
So living standards are still being squeezed, but there was at least some recognition of tightening family budgets. I caught up with Justine Roberts of Mumsnet to see how the statement went down on their influential website.
I think the overwhelming response on Mumsnet was to be underwhelmed, actually. A lot of the stuff had been flagged in advance, and I think that the few policies that were directly aimed at, if you like, the families market, one was free school meals and the other was married tax allowance, and I think they had a mixed reaction on Mumsnet. I think some people thought that perhaps they're not entirely the best way to spend scarce resources, and on the married tax allowance, I think there was a feeling that perhaps not all families are married, and there's a lot of single parents out there. What about them? So it didn't quite pass the fairness test in that regard. So I think underwhelmed is probably... But no one was screaming from the rafters about it either.
Joining us as well is Peter Kellner of YouGov. Peter, in one sense, it was deja vu all over again. More austerity, it lasts, it seems, forever. But is everything really remain the same, or is something starting to change where public opinion is concerned?
What our YouGov polls find is that when you ask people about the state of the economy or their own hopes for the future, it's not that they're optimistic, but they're a lot less pessimistic than they were a year or two ago. So that is beginning to turn around for the government. However, when you ask about cost of living, when you ask about the impact of the spending cuts, then views remain the same. And the bad news for Labour is when you ask people who they blame for the spending cuts, the figures simply haven't shifted. Labour continues to be more blamed now than they were 2 or 3 years ago, even though we've now had year after year of tough Conservative spending decisions. People are still blaming Labour more than the Conservatives.
So that's bad for Labour, but the thing that people are saying has changed this autumn has been a shift from focusing exclusively on the economy to talking about the cost of living as if it were almost a separate issue.
The big battle, I think, for the next 18 months after the next general election will be to control the economic narrative. Because what the UGIP figures show is that when you ask people which is better for the economy, for economic growth, for tackling the deficits, those, if you like, big macro issues, people say the Conservatives. They prefer David Cameron to Ed Miliband, they prefer George Osborne to Ed Balls. But when you say, who's concerned about your standard of living, then people go for Labour. And they say Labour has the better story, the better answers, much more concern for people like them. Now, in the long run, you can't have the economy and the standard of living going in completely opposite directions. So the big question, to which I don't know the answer, and we may none of us know the answer for at least a year, is which narrative will in the end dominate the debate up to the next election? Will it be the narrative about the state of the economy and the deficit, in which case the Tories are in pole position, or will people be much more concerned about their own individual situation and which party is most concerned about their own standard of living, their own cost of living, their own fuel prices, in which case Labour might pull ahead. That's the big tussle.
And we're joined as well by Robert Choate, who is the government's official top number cruncher as chair of the Office for Budget Responsibility. And Robert, slightly cheeky question, why do you guys keep getting it so wrong? The numbers kept being worse than we thought for years and years, and now they're loads better.
Well, that's the nature of economic forecasting. Partly it's because the factors that you're thinking about in terms of where is the economy going to go in the future changing, so what's going on in the world economy, what you think consumers are confronting, etc. But partly, of course, it's also about changes to where you think you have been in the past and where you are today. One of the striking things, if you look back at the history that the statisticians write of the 1990s recession, is the picture is still changing even 20 years after the event in terms of how deep that recession was, how long it lasted, how big the recovery has been. So again, on that recession, compare the numbers that you were getting in about 1994 with the latest ones, and the recession is possibly 40% shallower, about a year shorter, followed by a much bigger recovery. So I think one thing that all forecasters need to bear in mind is that you're dealing with the very, very early drafts of economic history. And so what looks like a good or a bad forecast today may look very different when you look at it in hindsight. And a lot of the reasons why forecasts change from today looking forward is that the starting point is different from what you'd expected. Take business investment as a very good example.
So you're kind of predictably wrong. Would you be willing to say a word on rebalancing? It was a phrase we heard a lot more about before the back at the beginning of the coalition. And then, as you say, investment has been marked down. Is there less rebalancing going on than we might have hoped?
Well, again, this is interesting. If you look at the forecast that we were producing in June 2010, and about a year ago, well, every year we look back and say, well, how things have turned out, what's that telling us about, you know, how those forecasts performed? Go back a year and it seemed that the errors that we'd made were pretty much evenly split between over-optimism on the amount that consumers were spending, over-optimism on the trade performance, and over-optimism on business investment. What you've seen is that shifting. So now business investment looks much the most important reason why we were over-optimistic about the pace of economic growth over that period. And if you again look at the total amount of cash spending in the economy, consumer spending, consumer household incomes actually performed pretty much as we anticipated back in June 2010. The errors have come because basically profits didn't pick up and business investment didn't pick up. So in that sense, different people have a different view on what's the optimal mix of consumption and investment, etc. But in terms of looking at where the errors, where the surprises have come, it's been the weakness on the corporate side rather than in the consumer side that affects where the cash growth in the economy has come over the last 2 to 3 years.
Robert Choate there, who's the chair chairman of the Office for Budget Responsibility. And you can find plenty more on the Autumn Statement on our website at theguardian.com/politics.
Fellow South Africans, our beloved Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, the founding president of our democratic nation, has departed.
Well, when the time finally came, it was Jacob Zuma, the third black president of South Africa, who announced the death of the first. Nelson Mandela, a man who spent 27 years in prison and emerged as perhaps history's greatest exponent of political reconciliation, had previously been seen in parts of the world as a divisive figure. But he finally was able to overturn a brutal apartheid regime and rise to the presidency, avoiding a civil conflict of the kind that's still too common in the continent and elsewhere in the world today. Hugh Muir, this feels like the right moment to recognise the political significance of a life rather than just a death.
Well, certainly I think that's what people here are trying to do, particularly within black communities here. He visited here quite often, actually, and the feeling here was that there was much to learn from him. Two things in particular, I think. One, to learn about the journey that he undertook, from a lawyer to rebel leader to prisoner to president, just this extraordinary trajectory. And I think that as a diaspora, what we always look at is trajectory, because in a way that's the stuff of our lives. And the other thing that we really took from him was not so much the ideology, but more the durability. Because I think the feeling that we have is that for us to move forward, it's not going to be easy, and you have to be very durable. And here was a very living example of that durability. And so there was always a real connection with Mandela when he came here. So, I think if you spoke to a lot of people, actually, they couldn't tell you exactly what his politics were. And I'm sure we'll touch on that later. But in a way, he had this thing about being everything to everyone. I think that's why those who supported him were so fervent in their support, and those who opposed him ended up respecting him.
And it is the case, isn't it, Seamus, that virtually everyone from all parts of the spectrum this morning are saluting a great man's memory.
Yeah, and that's right, because he was an absolutely towering historical figure, a great hero of the 20th century liberation struggles, a great anti-racist leader, a great political leader, and also an incredible personality. And so for all those reasons, who could not celebrate that life? But it is the most rank hypocrisy when you see the people who now speak up for Mandela in that way. I mean, most obviously from the Conservative Party, who, of course, supported apartheid at the time. Margaret Thatcher denounced Nelson Mandela in the 1980s as a terrorist. Ronald Reagan said that the apartheid regime in South Africa was essential to the free world. And now the same kinds of people like David Cameron, who went on a pro-apartheid junket to South Africa in the 1980s, are hailing Mandela. But of course,
admit he'd got the Conservative Party had that one wrong, didn't it? It was something he.
I think what people are missing is that it wasn't just the Conservative Party, but it was the entire Western establishment that effectively stood behind apartheid until very near the end of the apartheid regime. Norman Tebbit this morning said, well, we were right to call Nelson Mandela a terrorist because he launched a terrorist campaign, by which he meant the armed struggle that was launched by the African National Congress after all peaceful means of protest and changing the racist system had exhausted themselves. But of course, in modern political discourse, the armed guerrilla campaign would be regarded as a terrorist campaign today. And of course, they were hostile to the ANC because it was in alliance with the Soviet Union and supported by the Soviet Union when the West opposed it and supported South Africa. It was allied to countries like Cuba. And of course, when Nelson Mandela was released from prison, one of the first countries he went to in the world was to Cuba to thank them for their support. But that's all been sort of sanitized and erased from the historical record, because people want to embrace Mandela as something for themselves, where actually he was, a liberation leader. He was a socialist. He was actually a member of the South African Communist Party leadership at the time he was arrested in the early 60s. So I think we have to remember all that and see him as a real political figure and all his massive achievements and some failures.
But isn't that this part of the success, that he positioned himself or he carried himself in such a way that everyone did feel that they were able to claim him? And in a way, that's why he was able to be successful, because that way you head off the kind of confrontation and sort of obstacles that would have meant that there was no progress. People say about Bill Clinton, for example, in that he has this way of making everyone feel that he is with them. And I think that that's what Mandela was able to do as well. So you'll have some holdouts like Lord Tebbit today saying what he said, but elsewhere, I suppose, if you stick your nose in the air, you'll be able to. There'll be the smell of burning cotton as all these Tories burn their hang Mandela T-shirts. I mean, in a way, I'm slightly more charitable than you are, in that I suppose I'm prepared to say that is this hypocrisy, or is this just a sign that actually he was successful and people did move on, and people maybe do feel to some degree that the positions that they took before were slightly ridiculous?
Well, I think that's a fair point. I mean, of course, one of the reasons why Western leaders were able to change their tune about Mandela and the ANC was because part of the deal, in a way, of the end of apartheid was an accommodation with mainly white-owned big business in South Africa and internationally, which, from the ANC's point of view, meant a compromise with many of their original key socialist or progressive economic policies. And that's an argument within the ANC alliance now today. I think that's one of the reasons why they were able to sort of embrace him. But they also did it by just ignoring what Mandela continued to say. So, for example, Mandela spoke out very strongly against Western wars in Kosovo, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. It was very sharp in his denunciations of Western policy. But you find that's not mentioned in any of the reports today, just like a lot of the things about his history, because he is such a towering and impressive leader that I think, as Hugh says, people want to be able to embrace him. They know it's not really possible to raise these things in a critical way.
But wasn't there always a certain ambiguity? I mean, he certainly wasn't a doctrinaire Soviet-style communist, was he? I mean, when he was on trial in the early 60s, he spoke of his admiration for the United States. And I don't know, by then, was he a socialist still?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, I think you're right. He wasn't, although he was a member of the Communist Party for a period, he was first and foremost an African nationalist. But he was a progressive nationalist of that era, of the period of the anti-colonial struggle, sharing those ideas and socialist ideas which predominated at that time. I think he continued to express those despite these compromises and the kind of neoliberal turn that South Africa took under the ANC in the 90s and more recently. I mean, having said that, I mean, there also have been a number of very important social achievements in South Africa, quite apart from the democratic transformation, in house building, in schools, in power and water supplies. But there is huge inequality, and there is a continued domination of these big private companies, which is not, of course, what the ANC program stood for.
But I think, like all these people whose influence spans several countries and several borders, I think what he did was not so much sell the ideology as to sell core themes. I think, at the end of the day, what's really important about social movements is that they are very simple and they are about core human themes. And I think that that's what people saw in him. As I said, I think if you asked 5, 10 people what his ideology was, 8 of them probably would not be able to tell you. And actually, they wouldn't care as well, because it was the basic things that he was talking about humanity and about reconciliation and about how you go forward, having had such a dreadful past. I think those connect with people. And I think those connect with even with people who wouldn't share what ideology he may have had.
Did you hear President Obama speaking? I mean, I felt like his words were more genuine than the traditional kind of cap that gets nodded when someone dies, because of course he'll have seen parallels with the struggle for race equality in America.
Well, indeed, and I think that one can't compare the two of them, but I think one can compare them in terms of why they appeal to particularly to Black Britain, because I think that all the while, particularly when you sense that that what confronts you all the while is this sense that you're not quite equal. When you have these figures that are just towering figures and excellence, figures of excellence, no matter where they come from, really, you do cleave to them. You do you want them to do well, and you try to learn from them. And I think that in that way, both Obama and Mandela were similar in that we all felt that we had a stake in them. I mean, people who'd never been to South Africa, people who knew nothing about the struggle there, nevertheless felt that they had a stake in what Mandela was doing, and in a way felt that they had a stake in what Obama was doing. Just to pick up on your point as to how what actually happened in South Africa and whether or not the ANC compromised. I mean, I think in a way that had to be as it was, because I went there not long after they repealed the last Apartheid Act, and I remember driving out to a white, terre blanche country, basically, and talking to the white farmers there, and they were so angry, and in a way they were angry but trying to not be angry at him. It was very weird. He was kind of almost excluded from the argument. They were angry about what was happening, but they couldn't really direct it at him. And so I think even then, that the approach he took, I think, was probably the only one that would have worked.
So I think there's a different diffuser.
I think there's two different issues. One is the racial reconciliation and the successful attempt to stave off potential civil war,
which was remarkable, wasn't it? The Truth and Reconciliation
a huge
Commission.
Achievement and was completely successful. I was talking more about the economic policy shifts that happened around the same time, and there's an argument within the ANC and within the ANC alliance, which continues to this day, about that and whether that was necessary. And I think it very much chimed with the times of the early 90s and the post-Cold War atmosphere in the world generally. But I think, you know, as people have seen the consequences of that now, there's a question of whether there's time for a different direction. But I mean, I think that's just part of Mandela's legacy and the ANC legacy. But the you know, it's a part of something which is on a far bigger scale, of course.
There's as well as the advances Seamus talked about on social and economic things. There were some fairly for the time striking things by the standards of Africa at that time, weren't there? The abolition of the death penalty, gay marriage. I mean, one of the first places, never mind in Africa, in the whole world, Hugh. There is a practical legacy, isn't there?
Well, I think there is, and he, because of the authority he carried, is probably the only person who could have moved so far so quickly on that. I think that the moral authority is really key to a lot that he did. If you think of, I mean, if you bring it back here again and you think about the case of Stephen Lawrence, I mean, that case was pretty gridlocked until Mandela said something. And he didn't actually say that much. He just said, I knew that black life was cheap in South Africa and I didn't realise it was like that here. And it was almost the quiet raise of an eyebrow. I mean, it wasn't, you know, he wasn't very assertive and he certainly wasn't angry, but because it was him, the authorities felt they had to do something. And so I think that all the while, he's very clever and he knew what his moral authority was and he knew how to trade on it.
My thanks to Seamus Milne and to Hugh Muir for sharing those thoughts about Nelson Mandela, and also to the Resolution Foundation for hosting us today. The producer was Phil Maynard, I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.